This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Thanks for downloading the Briefing Room. We decided to postpone our programme on people who were persuaded to remain in the referendum. We're planning to bring you that next week, unless we need to brief you on anything else. This week, David Aronovich explores the movement some have accused of being behind the failed uprising in Turkey.
Friday night's attempted coup in Turkey. It ended in victory for the sitting government of President Erdogan, who immediately blamed a movement called the Gulenists. But who are the Gulenists? Were they responsible? And what will happen to them now? Step inside the briefing room and we'll try and find out. The BBC's Ed Sturton has long taken an interest in the, to us, strange world of Fethullah Gulen. Ed will be joining me later in a briefing room discussion, but first, here is his report.
Suspicions of an entryist plot by the Gulenists aren't new. In a video which surfaced in 1999, Fethullah Gulen apparently told his followers,
"You must move within the arteries of the system, without anyone noticing your existence, until you reach all the power centres. You must wait until such a time as you have got all the state power, until you have brought to your side all the power of the constitutional institutions in Turkey. Until that time, any step taken would be too early, like breaking an egg before waiting for the full 40 days for it to hatch."
That led to Mr. Gulen being charged with trying to undermine Turkey's secular state, and not long afterwards he left for the United States. He claimed the recording had been tampered with, and indeed he was later cleared in absentia of all charges. Suspicion about Gulen back then came from secular intellectuals. Today, it's Turkey's Islamist government that says he's behind a plot. Since last Friday, thousands of Turkish civil servants, police officers, judges and lawyers have been arrested, sacked or suspended. After a failed coup, you would expect some senior military officers to be locked up and punished, but teachers? More than 15,000 education staff have been suspended, and the licences of 21,000 teachers working in private institutions have also been revoked. Many of these people are suspected of links to the Gulen movement. So does it really constitute a so-called deep state dedicated to the overthrow of the elected government? 5 years ago, I investigated the Gulen movement for Radio 4, and they invited me to see one of the schools they run all over Turkey, and indeed the world. This is the kind of enterprise that's earned the movement admirers. A gleaming new school complex in the suburbs of Istanbul.
What's that?
Yeah, I mean, the lesson has just finished.
So you play the bell for the
Beethoven's Ode to Joy for the end of lessons.
Alper Derici, an English teacher, gave me a sense of the clean living ethos that is so much a part of the institutions associated with the movement.
In our school, there are no teachers who are divorced. We live in a strong family relationship. And also, we never drink alcohol. We don't smoke. We do sports with them all the time. We try to be cool and calm and patient most of the time.
Trying to describe the Gulen movement is a little like trying to nail jelly to the wall. Alperovici says his whole life is inspired by its ideals, but he'd never describe himself as a member because there's no organisation to be a member of. The leader of this non-organisation hasn't even set foot in Turkey for 17 years. Fethullah Gulen lives in self-imposed exile in the Pennsylvania countryside. He was born 75 years ago in Erzurum in northeast Turkey, was licensed as a state-approved imam in 1959, and steadily built up a reputation as a charismatic preacher, famously crying when powerfully moved by some great world event or simply when talking about the prophet. But his followers won't even describe themselves as a religious movement.
We don't provide extra religious education because 90% of the people are considered as a Muslim in Turkey.
What about the teachings of Fethullah Gulen? Because after all, this is an institution that's from his movement.
We do not utter his name or we do not say that he says this, so we must do it. I mean, although I'm a great follower of his books and his ideas, he just feeds me, I mean, let's say. I mean, I learn the positive things and how I can shelter my students most of the time. But unless they ask us anything, we do not provide extra information to them.
Would it be fair to say that most of the teachers, like you, are either supporters of Fethullah Gulen or participate in the movement in some way?
What he advises us just to educate the people for the peace of the world. Because in the past, we didn't have a lot of schools. So, for example, my father is an illiterate person. He can't read and write. So I thought that if we can educate our people, we can help to improve the economy, set a very healthy family cells everywhere. So education is the key. So all of the teachers here believe in the same idea.
If you ask one of Fethullah Gulen's supporters why his ideas are so appealing, you're likely to be love-bombed with non-confrontational language, concepts like dialogue, world peace, mutual understanding. But many of his supporters have also been extremely successful in an area which prizes hard-headedness and clarity of thought, business. The big institutions linked to the Gulen movement have included a bank, which was taken over by the authorities last year, and Turkey's Federation of Businessmen and Industrialists. I visited an Istanbul business with close Gulen connections.
Jackets everywhere. Lines and lines of jackets here.
With 600 sewing machines and a staff of 2,500, it made clothes under licenses from companies like Pierre Cardin. Ahmet Kavumarci, the man running it, was a product of a Gulen school and gave generously to Gulen causes. But, and this makes it just that little bit more difficult to grasp the true nature of the Gulen phenomenon, he preferred to use the term hizmet, which means service, rather than talking about a movement. I spoke to him and to another Gulen-supporting businessman, Murat Saralyi.
Scholarships is something that I think that's one of the very wide involvement of the community.
How much money do you give in that form?
Well, I would prefer to not to mention that.
Ahmed, would you be willing to say how much you give?
We can say that we are trying to give 10% of our yearly profit for these social organizations.
Most of it to Hizmet?
Maybe we can say 50% of it.
And what's your yearly profit? That must be public information, isn't it?
Last year it was about $20 million.
So about $1 million a year is what you're giving.
Maybe sometimes more than 10%. We are trying to give minimum 10%. We are trying to scholar about 500 students a year. We can say in Turkey, in Romania, in Tanzania, in Kazakhstan, in South Korea.
Back then, the jewel in the movement's cultural crown was Zaman, one of Turkey's most successful national newspapers. There was also an English edition of the paper called Today's Zaman, for which Kerim Balci was a columnist. He was put through school and university by Gulen scholarships and told me he owed his career in journalism to the movement. When I spoke to him in 2011, the Gulen Media Group was an advocate of the ruling Islamically-inspired AK Party.
Previously, ACK Party was named Welfare Party, and they were against European Union membership. They were against further minority rights. They were at least skeptical about democracy. But in year 2001, they created a new party that moved suddenly, overnight, to our position. What would we do? Change our positions just to put a difference to ACK Party?
But the thing that unites you and the ACK Party is a belief that religion has a place in public life, isn't it?
No, it's the opposite. Well, religion has a place in public life, and this is our position. This is not ACK Party's position. We are completely secular on political issues. We believe that if religion involves into politics, this corrupts both of them.
But earlier this year, Zaman was brought under government control by a court order. Turkish police raided the building and fired tear gas at protesters outside, and the editor-in-chief was removed. Until the events of the past few days, it was perhaps the most dramatic result of the split between Fethullah Gülen's supporters and President Erdogan's AK Party, which began at the end of 2013. In December that year, dozens of people close to the government, including the sons of three cabinet members, were detained in connection with a corruption investigation. Mr. Erdogan, who was Prime Minister at that stage, called it a foreign plot, and while he didn't name Fethullah Gülen, his followers had no doubt about whom he had in his sights. The first purge aimed at police officers, judges and prosecutors suspected of Gülen's sympathies began. In the aftermath of the split between Gülen and the AK, I interviewed Osman Can, a professor of constitutional law at Marmara University, who sat on the AK's central committee. Here's his judgment on the Gülen movement's ambitions.
They collect intelligent people from across Anatolia and they give them education, and then they became bureaucrats and officials, and they improve and they became very important bureaucrats in judiciary and police and military and in other central institutions. So after that, they are then able to control everything.
To what end do you think they want to control policy? What's the vision that they're working towards?
Their agenda is very hidden. You can't say something concrete on this movement. But they are religious. And after they control everything, it could be a religious totalitarian system. It is a prognosis from me.
Ed Sturton is with me here in the briefing room now. I'm also joined by Ferdevs Robinson, a London-based journalist and former editor with BBC World Service, and in Istanbul by the writer and analyst Gareth Jenkins. And also in the studio in London is a supporter of the Gülen movement, Dr. Ismail Sezgin, director of the Centre for Hizmet Studies, which is a London-based non-profit organisation providing research and analysis on the movement. Dr. Sezgin, you've met Fethullah Gülen. What's he like?
Well, I've met a lot of religious scholars because when I was 6 years old, I was in a dormitory. And I've seen many scholars. I didn't want to meet with him when I was at uni because I thought, there you go, he looks very shiny and good. But if I see him, that will be one of those people. And I went there for curiosity because I was in Pennsylvania as a work and travel visa as a student. And the only impression left from me then, and I wasn't then in, you know, like part of the movement, is that when he come from the other room after the prayer, we automatically, as Turkish instinct, we stand up, to me and my friend who we were visiting together. And actually, he saw us standing up and he stepped back and
winced.
Make a face, yeah, and put his hand down and the others pull us down. But when I didn't know that he didn't want people to make a, you know,
a big fuss
action,
of him coming
of.
In, yeah.
And I've seen, because it made me feel very, very bad to give him that pain. And I do recognize the reaction. Some people were, oh, sit down, but they want you to stand up as well. I've seen that honesty in there.
So you think he's a very modest man, a man who doesn't want to over-recognition.
My emphasis is in here, actually, when I say I met with thousands of scholars, because I have gone through that formal system, I'm emphasizing on honesty. Everybody says they don't want respect, they don't want something, they are not after it. And I've seen that for me.
Ferdinand Robinson, you've met him as well.
Yes, I have. I've been following Gulen movement since beginning of 1990s. In 1996, I was sent to Turkey for Radio 4 for a program called Europhile to do a program about Gulen movement. And I managed to secure an appointment with him. And with my very experienced producer colleague, Tim Huell, we went to meet him at the opening of his first private university, Fatih University in Istanbul. Very briefly, my first impression, it was a place where the president of the country, Süleyman Demirel, prime minister, various other leaders, including the leader of the right-wing party, National Action Party, they were all there. And first, the National Action Party leader arrived, and there was a huge applause from his followers. And then the president arrived. Of course, there was also polite applause. But when somebody started moving, coming towards us, there was incredible silence. You could have dropped a pin and you couldn't hear it.
And that was Gulen.
And that was Gulen. Finally, I interviewed him and met him for only 20 minutes or so. And we were investigating infiltration of the Gulen movement into Turkish military. So over the years, I met many Gulen followers in Central Asia and other places.
So you met him. Dr. Seskin, very briefly, what does, in your view, as a supporter, does the Gulen movement offer that conventional Islam doesn't?
Well, actually, he offers a conventional Islam which can be applicable in today. He doesn't say you have to change your way of life. He has to say you need to bring ethics in there. And there is a transformation in there. My grandfather never wanted a TV in his house. And he didn't let my father go beyond normal five-year education. And my father's generation had the education in the adjacent room. And Gulen said, well, actually, you need to open TV channels. You need to be in there. You need to be in here. And, you know, like, you don't need to be only Imam Hatip graduates. So that is the difference. He said, you can be a football player. You have to be just aware that kids are looking up to you and you have to sweat for what you paid for.
So in a sense, what he offered was a kind of a modernization and a transition point. Ed Sturton, is that your impression of the thing that the Gulen movement offers to Turkey at this point in its development?
It's very interesting what Dr. Kessin says. I think what I pick up on is actually the distinction, not so much between what you called conventional Islam and the Gulen movement, but between the AK's Islamism and the Gulen movement. The AK party believes in the idea of political Islam, whereas Fethullah Gulen's ideas are very much devotional, pietistic, if you like.
Now, the AK party, we should just stress, is the governing party of indeed. President Erdogan. Yeah.
So there's a fault line there. And while in the past they've both been singing from the same hymn sheet, both interested in the promotion of Islam generally in society and resisting the advance of secularism, that fault line was always there, and it's now come out very clearly, I think, between the two positions.
Ferdinand Robinson, Erdogan, as we've heard, and Gulen got on quite well. In a sense, they were selling themselves a bit to Ed as, if you like, the kind of movement that made Erdogan and the AKP become more modernised, become more friendly, and so on. Why then did they fall out with each other?
Well, they had a very useful alliance because AKP felt under threat, quite justifiably so, at the time they came to power, till they consolidated their power. And the Gulen movement also provided them with very well-educated, competent people to fill in places in state bureaucracy. Therefore, they helped each other up until a point where it turned into a power struggle. But also there were some crucial differences in their approach to big issues in Turkey. For example, the Kurdish issue. For example, relations with Israel. At one point, I think, they started taking quite clear action against elected government. And Gulen movement, of course, not being an elected political party, is not in any way accountable. Therefore, they fell out in a very serious way. And when they fell out, I think it brought not only AKP's rather authoritarian tendencies, but also Gulen movement's rather secretive and shadowy side.
Gareth Jenkins in Istanbul, how could a movement which doesn't actually have a political profile fall out with a party that is clearly overt and political? How can that take place?
It's not just a question of politics, I think. It's also a question of society. If you know, Turkey has been, in theory at least, a rigorously secular state. And a lot of the people who are conservative people were excluded from civil service and did feel that they were discriminated against just in everyday life. So this alliance of convenience, really, because these two, also the AK Party, people like Erdogan and also Gulen himself, they come from different strands even within the Islamist movement. So they came together because they thought they were not just opposing a political force, but also a social force, which had dominated Turkey, really going back to the 1930s.
Yeah, it's just very interesting that point about religiously minded people feeling excluded. One of the most striking interviews we did when we were doing this investigation was with a young woman who was working at the newspaper called Today's Zaman that you heard about a moment or two ago. And we said to her, what is it that you find appealing about this place and the ideals behind it? And she said, it's partly that I was educated by the Gulen movement or at a Gulen school and I feel I owe them a lot. But it's also the fact that I can wear this. And she pointed to her headscarf and she said, in many places, only the cleaning women, was how she put it, would be allowed to wear a headscarf. And she clearly felt empowered to fulfil a professional job, despite the fact that she was religiously minded, in a way I think many people had felt excluded about in the past.
Now, these all seem to me to be reasons why the AK party of Erdogan and the Gulenists would get on. What I'm still not absolutely clear about is why they should suddenly fall out. It's very much in their interest to get on with each other, Ferdinand Robinson, and that they fall out briefly. I mean, you mentioned Israel and so on, but that seems like a strange issue for people to have an argument about.
Well, these are crucial issues because what you do, for example, with the Kurdish issue in the southeast is absolutely the key subject for any government or any political party or any power that has any say in countries' affairs. But also, it came to a point where they stopped trusting each other because, as Ed said, a lot of people felt that they needed alliances to be able to work in places with a headscarf. But that was in the beginning. By the time we had 14 years of AKP government, this is no longer an issue. Everybody can wear anything they want. But the sort of not having confidence, not having trust in each other, still continued.
We heard the phrase in Ed Sturton's package, the deep state. What is the deep state in Turkey? Gareth Jenkins.
Well, it certainly used to be a kind of a network within the Turkish military, which had been set up to try to counter any Soviet occupation of Turkey back during the Cold War. But it's now become almost a shorthand for any form of network which operates outside the normal kind of institutional forms of operation.
Well, I suppose it's a bit like we use the phrase the establishment, or in America they talked about the military-industrial complex. It is the idea that there is a secret group of people making connections and exercising power beneath the surface. And if you live in a country where we've had not just attempted coups but successful coups in the not-so-very-different distant past, it's not at all paranoid to believe in such a thing.
Now, in the context of Turkey, presumably, it's traditionally been the kind of military trying to suggest that it is the continuous.
Well, it's gone through all these different transformations. As Gareth says, it was once those in the military involved in trying to work with the Americans and so forth. It then became the military secularists. It then became an alliance between the AK party and the Gulen movement. And it's now just the Gulen movement being accused by the AK party. So it's not a continuum, but the idea behind it is very strong and very powerful in Turkish society.
Gareth, briefly, how powerful actually is it? It feels like a conspiracy theory. Is it just kind of loose or is it something very tight?
The deep state, the deep state, it's real. I mean, I know some people who were in the original deep state when it was in the military, and this was something that was actually set up by NATO in all NATO countries. So it has its roots in reality. But, you know, in this part of the world, nothing happens without a conspiracy theory. And it tends to be almost a knee-jerk reaction to anything people can't immediately explain, is to say, oh, well, the deep state was behind it.
But one of the comparisons people make is between the Gulen movement and the Jesuits. And that is because the Jesuits are also very much involved in education, they're about values, but also because they became very powerful, at times so powerful that they challenged states and indeed were suppressed in Spain and Portugal. And I think that's part of the answer to your question about why the two sides fell out.
OK, and here's now the big question. Was the coup Gulenist? Gareth Jenkins.
It's very difficult. I mean, it certainly doesn't appear to be rational. Rationality has never been the best benchmark by which to try to understand Turkish politics. But if you have a vast organization which has really built its appeal on non-violence and dialogue, it's certainly very odd for that organization then to risk, you know, losing it all on the throw of a dice by trying to stage a coup. Of course, we have to wait to see what evidence comes out. But even if the Gulenists were responsible, as I said, it does seem very irrational and counterproductive, almost to the point of being suicidal.
Ferdinand Robinson, do you think Gulen pulled the strings on this one, issued an order from Pennsylvania?
I cannot say that. I think there are so many unanswered questions right now, and it is up to Turkish courts. It's not up to me or even up to President to declare who is guilty. Turkish courts will have to go through the due process and decide that. But if you ask me if a coup in Turkish military, which is, as we probably now pretty much confidently say, has quite a lot of Gulen sympathizers, supporters in it, pull out such a big operation without Gulen movements alliance or collusion or even turning a blind eye, if you put it that way, I would say no.
Since then, President Erdogan has described the coup, Gareth, as a gift from God. That seems a slightly odd way of describing a dangerous coup attempt on your government.
Yes, indeed, and a very worrying way of describing it. Of course, what we've seen since the coup happened, we've seen these massive purges. We've seen a declaration of a state of emergency. We've had today Turkey withdrawing from the European Convention on Human Rights. We've had a lot of things. I don't think there's any doubt that Erdogan has seen this as an opportunity not only to silence members of the Gulen movement, but also any other perceived opponents. At the same time, I think he, and he's right to a certain extent, I mean, this coup attempt was directed at him. It was an attempt to overthrow him. It was an attempt probably to kill him. So he's always been quite paranoid. And I think finally he's also found a reason for that paranoia. So you have this combination now of kind of opportunism and paranoia. But this has been very, very disturbing what we've seen over the last few days here.
İsmail Segin, what's happening to Gulen supporters right now in Turkey, as far as you know?
Well, they're keeping their heads down, as they used to be. It's not a safe country for expressing even your opinion.
I gather you've even had problems here in Britain. Can you tell me just a little bit about that?
It extends, it almost spills the borders. Now, there has been some attacks in the Gulen-affiliated places. There has been targeting. There has been boycott lists.
Here in Britain?
Yeah, and I think this is too early and too, if something I had learned as a Gulen follower is that, inspired person is, I wouldn't jump into conclusion because we have done it with Ergenekon case. We trusted people.
Sorry, that's a little bit detailed for people. I'm just wondering what examples you have of problems here in Britain right now.
Well, actually, there is a website. We are gathering this information and trying to keep a record, and you can see all the information there. But there has been a targeting of people, affiliated institutions, and verbal abuse and threatening text messages. Some of them are police matters already.
Gareth Jenkins, one very final thought. Is everybody else going to be swept up with Gulen supporters in this purge?
Unfortunately, I think yes. And we've already seen this in these 65,000 people who've been fired from their jobs. I know in the civil servants, I know some of them personally. These are most definitely not Gulen supporters. And I think what we've seen over the last few days is just the beginning. And gradually this suppression of anybody who's not seen as being sufficiently loyal to Erdogan will continue to expand.
Thank you very much. My thanks to my guests, Ed Sturton, Dr. İsmail Sezgin, Gareth Jenkins and Ferdevs Robinson. If tomorrow anyone asks you what you think of Gulenism, you'll be able to tell them. Till next week, goodbye.
The Briefing Room was presented by David Aronovich. It was produced by Phil Kemp with Kirstine Knight. The editor was Inez Bowen. Edward Sturton's original report on the Gulen movement was produced by Helen Grady. If you enjoyed the programme, why not write a review of it for your podcast provider?